face. And yet even here, as with my father, people can find meaning and spiritual growth in it. In many ways, it's probably the most common motivation for people to reevaluate and transform their lives. It's almost a cliche that people with serious or life-threatening illnesses start to savor each moment and to be more fully alive. I worked on a book many years ago with a physician who cared for seriously ill and dying patients. He made a powerful distinction between healing and curing. Curing involves the resolution of the illness, but was not always possible. Healing, he said, was coming to wholeness and could happen whether or not the illness was curable. The Archbishop explained how he was planning to be cremated, to conserve space, and wanted a simple funeral to encourage others in his country to avoid the expensive caskets and ceremonies that are traditional. Even in death, moral leaders teach by their choices. Then the Archbishop looked at me with a common-sense finality.
Death is a fact of life. You are going to die. It's actually a wonderful thing to do what they call a living will, where you are giving instructions for when the end comes. It's not being morbid. You're saying, this is a fact of life. I've conducted a number of funerals myself, and I've come to the stage where I'm saying, by the way, this is where you are going. That could so easily be you now. Yes, of course, there is a kind of nostalgia for the things that you have had that you will miss. I will miss my family. I will miss the person who has been my partner for these 60 years. There are many things that I will miss, but in this Christian tradition to which I belong, I will be entering into a fuller life. It is wonderful. I mean, imagine if we didn't die. Our poor world would not be able to carry the burden. It's not able to carry the burden of 7 billion as it is. I mean, I have had a beginning, I've had a middle, and I'll have an end. There is a lovely symmetry about it. Symmetry. If we didn't die, imagine the number of people that would be in the world now. I hope that the things I believe about heaven are really true. That I will meet my loved ones, my parents, my older brother, whom I didn't know because he died in infancy. I will meet many wonderful stalwarts. I want to meet St. Augustine. I want to meet St. Thomas Aquinas and people who have taught us so much about praying. Because God is God. Because God is infinite. Because none of us who are creatures will ever fathom the infinitude that is God. Heaven is going to be forever a place of new discovery. I would say, oh God, you're so beautiful. And I will call, come, come and see. And this other one will say, have you seen just how beautiful God is?
The Archbishop fell silent. Perhaps death and the fear of death is truly the greatest challenge to joy. Well, when we are dead, it doesn't really matter, but it is the fear of its approaching, of the suffering that often precedes it, and ultimately the fear of the oblivion and the loss of our personhood that frightens us. Many psychologists say that the fear of death lies behind all other fears, and many historians of religion argue that religion arose to try to solve the mystery of death. Modern life keeps that fear at bay, as we don't interact with the very old or the very sick, and illness, frailty, and death get tucked away behind institutional walls from our everyday lives.
I think for thousands of years, the human mind has been curious about death, and many traditions have many ideas and concepts of what will happen next. Heaven, as you mentioned, is a beautiful understanding. Shintoism in Japan also has the idea that after death, you automatically go to heaven, where all your ancestors are living. When many people think about death, they are very afraid. Usually, I tell them that you should accept that death is part of our life. There's a beginning, and there's an end, as you mentioned. So once we accept that it is normal, and that sooner or later it will come, our attitude changes. Some people are embarrassed when asked about their age, or pretend that they are still young. This is silly. Deceiving oneself. We should be realistic.
Yes, yes.
If a person is sick, it is much better to accept that you have some kind of illness and get medical treatment, rather than saying nothing is wrong and deceiving yourself.
While the Archbishop was in Dharamsala, we had arranged for him to see Yeshe Dandan, one of the Dalai Lama's doctors. Rachel is an integrative physician and was interested to know if this revered healer might have helpful recommendations for the Archbishop, whose prostate cancer was back. In an amazing coincidence, Dr. Dandan had helped cure my mother of blood cancer while he was visiting New York many years ago when I was still in high school. When I was in Dharamsala in January preparing for the visit, I was told that Dr. Dandan had died, but I had just heard that he was still alive at almost 90. I was excited to meet him, to thank him for helping to save my mother's life, and to see if he might be able to help the Archbishop. He came into the Archbishop's bedroom at the hotel, his bald head and large ears making him look a little like an only slightly taller Yoda from the Star Wars movies. His face was impassive, and his hands had a powerful delicacy while they took the Archbishop's pulse. The Archbishop was lying on his king-size bed. Through the windows, the valleys of Dharamsala plunged down in steep hillsides of oak and evergreens, ending with a vista of the vast plains below. Through a translator, Dr. Dandan began to describe health issues that the Archbishop had experienced decades ago and that had led to his current prostate cancer. The Archbishop looked surprised as Rachel, who was familiar with many traditional medical systems, explained what Dr. Dandan was saying in a way that made sense to a modern medical understanding of the body. After a 15 or 20-minute exam, Dr. Dandan pointed to the can of Coke Zero on the bedside table. The Archbishop has given up the rum and Cokes he used to favor, but he is still quite fond of his Coke Zero, having agreed to the diet soda to cut down on his sugar consumption. According to Dr. Dandan, the Coke Zero was still not helping his health and should be removed from his diet. When this was translated to the Archbishop, he got out of his bed rather spryly and jokingly waved his hand saying, "I think it's time for you to go." Rachel assured the Archbishop that while she had been trying to get him to kick his Coke Zero habit for years, at 84 he was allowed to eat and drink what he pleased. Dr. Dandan made some additional recommendations. Photos were taken together of the famous doctor and famous patient, and then the good doctor left.
As a Buddhist practitioner, I take seriously the contemplation of the Buddha's first teaching about the inevitability of suffering and the transient nature of our existence. Also, the Buddha's last teaching at the time of his death ends with the truth of impermanence, reminding us how it is the nature of all things that come into existence to have an end. The Buddha said nothing less. So, it is important that in our daily meditation practice, we continue to think about our own mortality. There are two levels of impermanence. At the grosser level, life keeps changing and things cease to exist, including us. At the more subtle level, in every single moment, everything is changing. Something science is able to show us happening even at the atomic and the subatomic level. Our body is constantly changing, as is our mind. Everything is in a constant state of change. Nothing remains static, and nothing remains permanent. In fact, as the Buddha reminds us, the very causes that have given rise to something, such as our life, have created the mechanism or the seed for that thing's eventual end. Recognizing this truth is an important part of the contemplation on impermanence. Then I ask why impermanence happens. The answer is because of interdependence. Nothing exists independently. So this kind of contemplation is part of my usual daily meditation practice. This practice is actually to help one prepare for death, the intermediate state, and then rebirth. So in order to carry out the practice effectively, you should reflect on these things and visualize the process of death. Finally, I think you mentioned that we old people should prepare for death, and it is important to make space for the future, for younger generations. What is important to remember is that sooner or later, death comes, and to make our life meaningful while we are alive. I think maximum lifespan is about 100 years. Compared to human history, 100 years is quite short. So if we utilize that short period to create more problems on this planet, our life would be meaningless. If we could live for 1,000,000 years, then maybe it would be worthwhile to create some problems. But our life is short. Now, you see, we are guests here on this planet, visitors who have come for a short time. So we need to use our days wisely to make our world a little better for everyone.
Jinpa explained that there is a profound teaching by an ancient Tibetan master. The true measure of spiritual development is how one confronts one's own mortality. The best way is when one is able to approach death with joy. Next best way is without fear. Third best way is at least not to have regrets.
So, earlier I was explaining about the night we fled from Norbolinka. For me, that was the most frightening night of my life, the night of the 17th of March, 1959. At that time, my life really was in danger. I still remember the alertness of mind I felt as I stepped out of the Norbolinka Palace in disguise, dressed in a Tibetan layman's clothes. All my efforts to calm down the situation in Lhasa had failed. A huge crowd of Tibetans had gathered outside the Norbolinka Palace, wanting to block any attempts on the part of the Chinese military to take me away. I had tried my best, but both sides, the Chinese and the Tibetans, were deeply entrenched in their positions. Of course, the Tibetan side was deeply devout and was trying to protect me.
The Dalai Lama paused and looked reflective as he recalled the devotion of his people and their self-sacrifice for his safety. This spontaneous gathering of Tibetans outside Norbolinka Palace was the culmination of days of uprising against the communist Chinese occupation by the Tibetan people that first began on March 10, 1959. This time, the public had come to prevent the Chinese authorities from taking the Dalai Lama away from Norbolinka Palace, supposedly for his own personal safety. Something had to happen. The situation was explosive, and the Dalai Lama knew that it could only lead to a massacre.
So that night, 17th of March, 1959, the plan for my escape was executed. We went at night, and in disguise along a road that followed a river. On the other side of the river was the Chinese military barracks. We could see the guards. No one in our party was allowed to use flashlights, and we tried to minimize the sound of the horses' hooves. But still, there was danger. If they saw us and opened fire, we were finished. Yet, as a Buddhist practitioner, I thought of Shantideva's somewhat stern advice. If there is a way to overcome the situation, then instead of feeling too much sadness, too much fear, or too much anger, make an effort to change the situation. If there is nothing you can do to overcome the situation, then there is no need for fear or sadness or anger. So I told myself at that moment that even if something were to happen to me, it would still be okay. You face the facts, the reality, and making an attempt to escape was the best response in the face of that reality. Actually, fear is part of human nature, It's a natural response that arises in the face of a danger. But with courage, when in fact real danger comes, you can be more fearless, more realistic. On the other hand, if you let your imagination run wild, then you exacerbate the situation further and bring more fear. Many people on this planet worry about going to hell, but this is not much use. There is no need to be afraid. While we remain on Earth worrying about hell, about death, about all the things that could go wrong, we will have lots of anxiety, and we will never find joy and happiness. If you are truly afraid of hell, you need to live your life with some purpose, especially through helping others. So, I prefer to go to hell than to heaven. I can solve more problems in hell. I can help more people there.
Meditation. Now I'll tell you a secret thing. We arrived at the Dalai Lama's complex early in the morning as the sun was still waking up. We went through the vigilant security, which reminded us that not all were as loving toward the Dalai Lama as he was toward them. I had decided to see the pat-down, not unlike those we are often subjected to at airports, as a brief massage rather than as an intrusion of my personal space or as an accusation of my potential danger. I was already learning how much one's perspective shaped one's reality. We crossed the brief distance to the Dalai Lama's private residence. We were later told that some of the people who had worked with the Dalai Lama for 30 years had never been inside. This was his retreat, one of the few places where this very public man could experience solitude, and it was a great privilege to be welcomed into his inner sanctum. From the outside, the Dalai Lama's home is a yellow-painted concrete structure with a green roof, like so many in Dharamsala. The double doors and walls have plenty of glass to let in the high-altitude light. On the roof is a balcony where the Dalai Lama can take a morning constitutional and look out at his beloved greenhouse filled with purple, pink, and white delphiniums and marigolds bursting like tiny suns. Beyond, he can see a panoramic vista down to the lush green Indian plains, and in the other direction, the towering glacial Talador Mountains, cloaked in white snow year-round. While far less grand than the Patala of his youth, his residence has a modest elegance and warmth that the endless thousand-room palace with its empty, ghost-haunted rooms must have lacked. We followed the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop into the house as the now brightening light streamed in through the glass window panels. The curtains were held back with ties, and the ceiling was painted black and red. The hallway was hung with brightly colored tongkas, and the hall was narrowed by bookshelves piled high with golden-spined sacred texts.
Now, this is my, how do you say, living room, a prayer room.
It seemed fitting that his living room was his prayer room, since so much of his life is spent in prayer and meditation. As we entered the room, we saw a large, glassed-in altar with a statue of a somewhat emaciated Buddha. Along the sides of the case were traditional Tibetan sacred texts, which looked like rectangular blocks. This altar was similar to a break front in a Western home that might be filled with silver or porcelain objects. On a ledge was a tablet displaying the face of a clock, which chimed out the hours. As we entered the room, we saw a much larger altar, which was also encased in glass, with a statue of a standing Buddha at the center.
Now, this statue is from the 7th century, am I right?
Right, 7th century, Jinpa confirmed.
He was a member of the monastery where this statue once stood.
Known as Kirong Joo, literally the brother from Kirong, this statue of the Buddha is revered as one of the most precious religious treasures of the Tibetan people. It was clothed in a traditional Tibetan robe and crowned with a golden jeweled coronet. It was surrounded by dozens of smaller statues of the Buddha and other sacred figures and was framed by white and purple orchids. The statue was beautifully carved sandalwood, and its face was painted gold. The eyes were wide set, the eyebrows thin, the lips curving, the whole face serene. The statue's right hand was extended, palm up, in a gentle gesture of welcome, acceptance, and generosity.
Wonderful.
Originally, there were two similar statues, both carved from the same single piece of sandalwood. And, since the time of the fifth Dalai Lama, one was housed in the Potala Palace.
The great fifth, as he is often called, lived in the 17th century and united central Tibet, ending its many civil wars. He is the Charlemagne of Tibet, or maybe the Charlemagne and the Pope combined.
While one statue was in the Potala, this statue was in western Tibet. They were like two brothers, twins. So eventually, when the Chinese army destroyed the Potala, that one was killed.
It might have been a misspoken word, but his personification of the statue and its death did seem quite poignant.
Then the monks in western Tibet smuggled this one out of Tibet and into India. So then there was a question of whether it should go with the monks of that monastery to South India, where they were resettled, or stay here with me. I made some investigations in the mysterious way. Divinations, which I think you also have in African culture. So then this statue, how do you say?
He spoke in Tibetan to Jinpa, who then translated. The divination revealed that the statue preferred to stay with the one who is more famous. Everyone laughed.
Now I'll tell you a secret thing, something quite unique. Each morning, you see, I pray to this statue. Then I see his facial expression changing.
The Dalai Lama had a mischievous look, and it was hard to know whether he was pulling the Archbishop's leg.
Really?
The Archbishop tried not to sound too incredulous. The Dalai Lama rocked his head from side to side, as if to say, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't.
Does it smile?
Yes. It is smiling like you, really.
The Dalai Lama leaned in and touched foreheads with the Archbishop. Then he wagged a finger at him.
Oh, but not like your eyes, so big and round.
The Dalai Lama's eyes went wide with an expression that could be surprise, fear, or anger.
Okay, now our session.
But as he walked to his chair, he stopped at another altar in the center of the room. On the round table was a very lifelike crucifix carved out of white marble, with black nails sticking out of the palms of the hands. There was also a statue of the Madonna.
Now, this is a black Madonna from Mexico.
The statue was of Mary wearing a golden robe and crown and holding a golden orb of the world. On her lap was a small baby Jesus.
Mary is a symbol of love.
The Dalai Lama gestured at the statue with the same open palm of the sandalwood Buddha.
It's wonderful.
There was also a deep blue globe nested in a golden stand, a sacred symbol perhaps of another kind, and a tangible reminder of the Buddhist understanding of interdependence. The Dalai Lama's prayer practice and concern, like the Archbishop's, enveloped the whole world. The Dalai Lama showed the Archbishop over to a heavily cushioned beige chair with a high-winged back. The Archbishop wore a navy blue Tibetan shirt with the button in the corner, near the shoulder, which made the shirt seem like a pouch into which he had been snugly fit. A skilled tailor, Lama Tenzin's father, had specially made it for him as a gift. The Archbishop sat down, his small frame practically disappearing into the large chair. The rest of us began to sit down on the floor, and the Dalai Lama asked whether we wanted chairs, but we said we were quite happy.
Originally, I also used to sit on the floor, but I started to have this problem with my knees, so now I prefer like this.
He gestured to a wide chair draped in a red velvety fabric. He pulled his robes up a little and sat down. Behind him, a yellow, red, and green tonka hung on the wall. In front of him was a low wooden table with a stack of Buddhist texts, shaped like horizontal literary blocks. Two long, thin lamps, sentinels on either side of the table, likely lit the table and the long Tibetan scriptures in the early mornings when the Dalai Lama began his practice. A pot of pink tulips and a gold-colored bowl for ceremonial rice throwing added some color. Finally, two slender tablets also stood on the crowded table, one to display the weather and the other to listen to BBC News.
Because of our program today, I started my meditation at 2:30.
The Archbishop was perhaps still marveling at this very early rising.
Then, as usual, shower and then continue my meditation practice. Now you feel okay? Temperature is okay?
The Dalai Lama was extending his hands with concern. The Archbishop smiled and gave him the thumbs up as they settled in beside each other.
Thank you.
This part is a clear light of death meditation. We are training our mind by going through quite a detailed process for what we will experience at the time of death.
The Archbishop's eyes were wide as if he had just been invited to warm up for the spiritual Olympics with a short marathon.
According to Buddhist Vajrayana psychology, there are different levels of consciousness. There's a dissolution that occurs as the grosser levels of our bodily and mental states come to an end, and when more and more subtle levels become manifest. Then, at the innermost or most subtle level, this state of clear light arises at the moment of dying. Not death, dying. Physical feeling completely ceases. Breathing ceases. Heart ceases. It's no longer beating. Brain also ceases its functioning. Still subtle, very subtle levels of consciousness remain, getting ready for another destination of life.
The consciousness at the moment of death that the Dalai Lama was describing is free of duality and content and abides in the form of pure luminosity. In a popular Hollywood comedy, Caddyshack, there is a scene where Bill Murray's character, Carl, describes a tall tale about carrying golf clubs for the 12th Dalai Lama on a glacier. Carl asked for a tip after the game, and the Dalai Lama is said to have responded, "Oh, there won't be any money. But when you die, on your deathbed, you will receive total consciousness." Perhaps the screenwriters were onto something and knew about the clear light of death meditation.
So, in Buddhist thought, we speak of death, intermediate state, and rebirth. In my case, I undertake this kind of meditation 5 times in a day. So on a daily basis, I kind of go through death and rebirth. 5 times I leave, and 5 times I come back. So I suppose when I actually die, I should be well prepared, but I don't know. When actual death comes, I hope I will have the ability to apply this practice effectively. I don't know. So I need your prayers.
The Chinese say you will not decide who your reincarnation will be.
The Archbishop was returning to a source of humor throughout the week. For the Archbishop, one did not want to miss the opportunity to link prayer to politics and meditation to activism, or a good joke. Certainly, the declaration that the Chinese government, which does not sanction or accept religion, would choose the next reincarnation of the Dalai Lama was fodder for another good laugh.
I prefer, after my death, that you search for my reincarnation. That you carry the investigation rather than an anti-religious, atheistic, communist government.
The Archbishop paused, perhaps wondering how he would carry on the investigation to find the next Dalai Lama.
Yes.
I usually say, first, Chinese Communist Party should accept the theory of rebirth, then they should recognize Chairman Mao Zedong's reincarnation, then Deng Xiaoping's reincarnation. Then they have a right to be involved with the Dalai Lama's reincarnation.
Yes, I was very interested, because they claim to be atheists and all of that. But they say they will decide whether you are going to be reincarnated. That is quite something.
The archbishop was chuckling and shaking his head at the absurdity of the Chinese government trying to restrict the Dalai Lama's movements, even in the next life. Then words fell away. Dialogue and jokes settled into quiet contemplation. The Dalai Lama took off his glasses. His beautiful face was so familiar, and yet suddenly quite different. His face looked long and oval, from his wide, balding scalp, over his triangular eyebrows and slightly opened eyes, to his straight, broad nose, and peaked cheeks that looked chiseled now and weathered like the cliff face of a Himalayan summit, then to his straight and pursed lips, and ending with his soft, rounded chin. He looked down, as if the shades of his mind had been drawn, and now he was concerned only with the inward journey. The Dalai Lama scratched his temple, and I felt relieved that he was not some austere ascetic who would deny his itches and aches. He wrapped his cloak more tightly around his shoulders and settled into quiet, his hands resting in his lap. At first my mind started racing, and I was having a hard time staying focused, thinking about the questions I would ask, the video camera that was filming, the other people in the room, and if everything was as it should be and everyone had what they needed. Then as I watched the Dalai Lama's face, my own mirror neuron system seemed to resonate with the mind state that I was witnessing. Mirror neurons allow us to imitate others and experience their internal states, and therefore may play an important role in empathy. I started to experience a tingling in my forehead and then a sharpening of focus as various parts of my brain started to quiet and calm, as if the activity began to center on what spiritual adepts have called the third eye, or what neuroscientists call the middle prefrontal cortex. Daniel Siegel had explained to me that the neural integration created by this crucial area of the brain links many disparate areas and is the locus of everything from emotional regulation to morality. Meditation, he and other scientists have proposed, helps with these processes. He explained that the integrative fibers of the discerning middle prefrontal cortex seem to reach out and soothe the more reactive emotional structures of the brain. We inherited the reactivity of this part of our brain and the particularly sensitive amygdala from our skittish fight-or-flight ancestors. Yet so much of the inner journey means freeing ourselves from this evolutionary response so that we do not flip our lid or lose our higher reasoning when facing stressful situations. The real secret of freedom may simply be extending this brief space between stimulus and response. Meditation seems to elongate this pause and help expand our ability to choose our response. For example, we can expand the momentary pause between our spouse's annoyed words and our angry or hurt reaction. Can we change the channel on the mental broadcasting system from self-righteous indignation? How dare she or he speak to me like that? To compassionate understanding. She or he must be very tired. I will never forget seeing the Archbishop do exactly this, pause and choose his response, during a pointed challenge I had made some years ago. We had been engaged in two full, exhausting days of interviews, hoping to create a legacy project around his pioneering work with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. We were many hours into the dialogue with a film crew, and he was visibly tired and, frankly, a little cranky. It was not easy work to try to describe systematically the process of truth, forgiveness, and reconciliation that he had used so effectively, but often instinctively, to heal his country. At one particularly tense moment, I had asked him about his decision to return to South Africa from England, an event that had profound implications for the anti-apartheid movement and the freeing of his country, but also had quite painful consequences for his wife Leah and their children. Not only were they leaving a country where they were free and equal citizens to return to an oppressive and racist society, but also they were choosing to break up their family as well. The apartheid government had created Bantu education for blacks and other non-whites, an educational system that had the specific goal of educating its students for menial jobs. It was the purposeful mental subjugation of generations of students. This would never be tolerable for the Archbishop and Leah, and they knew they would need to send their children away to a boarding school in Swaziland. This had been one of the most difficult moments in their marriage, and it had almost broken them. Certainly, it had caused Leah enormous pain. After saying that few marital disputes are vindicated by history, I asked the Archbishop if he had ever apologized to Leah for the pain his decision had caused. He defended his decision with the true righteousness of the cause, and perhaps a little of the entitlement of a man of his generation. I pushed him hard about why he had not apologized for the anguish it had caused Leah, even if the decision had been the right one. As my verbal assault became more pointed and challenging, I saw his head draw back in reaction and perhaps some defensiveness. Most of us might have argued more adamantly or attacked back in such a disagreement, but it was as if I could see the Archbishop, in a split-second pause, collect his consciousness, reflect on his options, and choose his response, one that was thoughtful and engaged rather than reactive and rejecting. It was one of the most profound examples of what a prayerful and meditative life can give us, that pause, the freedom to respond instead of react. A few weeks later, he wrote to me that he had discussed the experience with Leah and had apologized. She told him that she had forgiven him long ago. Marriages, even the best ones, perhaps especially the best ones, are an ongoing process of spoken and unspoken forgiveness. The Archbishop cradled his right hand in his left. He hung his head in concentration. The goal was meditation, but I had never been quite sure where meditation ends and prayer begins, or where prayer ends and meditation begins. I've heard it said that prayer is when we speak to God, and meditation is when God answers. Whether it is God answering, or some wiser part of our own intelligence, I'm not sure it mattered to me, as I was just trying to quiet the inner noise and listen through the thick and enveloping silence. After the Dalai Lama ended the meditation, it was the Archbishop's turn to share his spiritual practice. The Archbishop begins his day with prayer and meditation in the small closet-sized upstairs chapel in his home in Cape Town. Before becoming the Archbishop of Cape Town, he and his family lived in Soweto, the former black township outside of Johannesburg that was so central to the anti-apartheid struggle and the site of the Soweto uprising. There he had a slightly larger, semi-detached chapel with a stained glass window and actual pews. It was a lovely cloistered space, and we had spent some beautiful moments of quiet together in there. It felt like being in the spiritual headquarters of the anti-apartheid struggle, where the Archbishop had turned to God so many times in anguish and uncertainty and found direction. The Archbishop and Impa got the bread and wine ready.
A Buddhist monk does not take wine or any alcohol, in principle, that is. But today, with you, I will take a little. Don't worry, you can rest assured, I will not be drunk.
I still won't let you drink and drive.
This is the first time we get to pray together. One Buddhist, one Christian. Brothers, I mentioned to you that since 1975 I have been making pilgrimages to different religious traditions. Sometimes it takes a major disaster for followers of all different faiths to come together and see that we are the same, human brothers and sisters. I consider what we are doing today to be part of that same kind of pilgrimage. When I look at this statue of Jesus Christ, I am really moved. I think this teacher has brought immense inspiration to millions of people. Now, it is time for your meditation.
The Archbishop and Impaugh handed out the small prayer booklets and led the Eucharist, also called Holy Communion. This rite is considered to be a reenactment of the Last Supper, which was a celebration of the Jewish Passover meal. Jesus is believed to have said that his followers should eat the bread and drink the wine as a remembrance of him. And for many Christians, the bread is transformed into Christ's body and the wine into his blood. The Eucharist celebrates Jesus' sacrifice of himself. I had joined the Archbishop for Eucharist many times, usually as the only Jew, a point that the Archbishop enjoyed pointing out, often adding that I was there to make sure the Eucharist was kosher. As a non-Christian, I did not actually receive communion, so it was a surprise to see the Archbishop and the Dalai Lama break convention in both of their traditions. Many Christian denominations forbid those who are not Christians, or even other Christians who are not of their specific denomination, those with whom they are not in full communion, from sharing in the Eucharist. In other words, like so many religious traditions, it defines who is part of the group and who is not. This is one of the greatest challenges that humanity faces, removing the barriers between who we see as us and who we see as other. The latest brain scan research suggests that we have a rather binary understanding of self and other, and that our empathy circuits do not activate unless we see the other person as part of our own group. So many wars have been fought, and so much injustice has been perpetrated, because we've banished others from our group, and therefore our circle of concern. I remember the Archbishop starkly pointing out this fact during the Iraq War, when the tallies of American and Iraqi casualties were reported and valued differently by the media in the United States. In the Archbishop's tally, these were all of God's children, indivisible and valued equally. The Archbishop and the Dalai Lama are truly two of the most inclusive religious figures in the world, and throughout the week, the theme underlying their teachings was about transcending our narrow definitions and finding love and compassion for all of humanity. The sharing of traditions that we were engaged in that morning was a reminder to put aside our own narrow beliefs of self and other, ours and theirs, Christian and Buddhist, Hindu and Jew, believer and atheist. In the land of Gandhi that we were in, I thought of his totemic words when asked if he was a Hindu. "Yes, I am. I am also a Christian, a Muslim, a Buddhist, and a Jew." We were looking for human truth, and we would drink from the cup of wisdom from whatever source it came. The Dalai Lama took a booklet.
"Is it English?"
"It's English, yes. Do you want to read it in Xhosa?"
"That one, I don't know."
"For your sake, we will use English."
"Thank you. Thank you."
"But the language of heaven is Xhosa. When you get up there, they are going to have to find a translator for you."
"There is connection. You see, historians say that the first human beings came from Africa, our real ancestors. So God's creation began in Africa."
"Not very far from my home, the site that they say is the cradle of humankind. So, although you look like you look, you are an African."
"The European, the Asian, the Arab, the American?"
"They are all African. We are all African. Some of us were farther away from the heat and their complexions changed. Now, we want to be quiet."
"Yes, first you should be quiet, then we will follow."
One last tease before sanctity descended, although I often felt like for these two men, holiness and lightheartedness were indivisible. The Dalai Lama now sat there with his lips pursed together reverentially. As the service began, he nodded his head attentively. When we stood, he stood straight and wrapped his crimson cloak around him. His hands were pressed together, his fingers laced. I knew that each leader was used to serving as the representative of their entire tradition, and the Dalai Lama was attempting to offer his respects on behalf of the whole Tibetan Buddhist, perhaps the whole Buddhist, community. Impaugh Tutu wore a bright red dress and a matching red headscarf, as well as a black cloak. She began with a prayer for all of those places where injustice exists. where there is strife, and continued to offer prayers of healing for all of those who are in need. She concluded by blessing the work that we were doing together. We finished the prayers and affirmations of the Eucharist with the words, "Peace be with you, the peace of the Lord be with you." Everyone went around to kiss and embrace one another. The Dalai Lama was behind his meditation table. I was thinking about how few embraces he must get and went over to greet him. And Pa did too. Then the Archbishop did as well. They held hands and bowed to each other. Now was the time for communion. The Archbishop lifted up a small piece of Tibetan white bread and placed it in the Dalai Lama's mouth. One could see the beaded Ubuntu bracelet on the Archbishop's wrist, affirming our connectedness and interdependence to one another. It was the reminder that we can be in communion with everyone. Then Impa approached with a glass of red wine. The Dalai Lama dipped the tip of his left ring finger into the glass and then placed the smallest drop into his mouth. After giving everyone communion, the Archbishop used his finger to collect all the crumbs so not a smidgen of the symbolic body would be discarded, then poured any remaining bits into the glass of watered-down wine and drank it. The Archbishop ended with a blessing in Xhosa, clicking repeatedly in the beautiful sound poetry of his native language, crossed himself, and then made the sign of the cross over the gathered fellowship.
"I'm driving you out. Go out into the world. Go in peace to love and serve the Lord. Hallelujah. Hallelujah. In the name of Christ, amen. Hallelujah. Hallelujah."
Before we left, the Dalai Lama stopped to take some pills, which he explained were Tibetan medicines. He chewed them up, his face puckering at their bitter taste.
"That's why you are looking so handsome."
"Because of God's grace."
Rachel then added, "God's grace sends the Tibetan doctor."
"In terms of physical strength, God loves the non-believer more than the believer."
The Dalai Lama laughed. The Archbishop began to cackle, too, as he took his cane and started to walk away, but then turned around.
"Don't laugh at your own jokes, man."
"You taught me to do that."
Then the Dalai Lama got up, wrapped his cloak around his shoulders, and took the Archbishop's arm.
"Thank you very much. Very impressive."
"Thank you for your hospitality."
They exited back down the dark hallway lined with tankas. The bright light was streaming in through the windows at the end of the hallway now. They stepped outside and down the concrete stairs, the Archbishop moving slowly, bracing himself with the handrail. A car was waiting, but the Archbishop and the Dalai Lama decided to walk up the path together to the conference room where the interviews were being filmed. The Dalai Lama took the Archbishop's hand, the one that held the cane. They walked together, rather nimbly.
"Have you had any problems with security here?"
"No, no."
"I'm quite surprised."
"No, I usually describe myself as the longest guest of the Indian government. Now, 56 years.
56? "But I mean, there have not been any intruders. People who have wanted to come in here and attack you."
He was no doubt thinking of his own death threats and the actual plan to assassinate him. It was foiled by the embrace of a crowd of people that had surrounded him at the airport and prevented the would-be assassin from getting close enough.
"No, no. 24 hours a day, India provides protection."
"Quite amazing. But even so, they can be quite clever. They can infiltrate the security establishment and you think that it is someone who is coming to protect you, and it turns out..."
"Even in the White House, someone entered without much notice."
"It is wonderful that you have been able to be secure here."
"The only danger is an earthquake."
Days 4 and 5, The 8 Pillars of Joy. Pillar 1, Perspective. There are many different angles.
As we said right at the beginning, joy is a byproduct. If you set out and say, I want to be happy, clenching your teeth with determination, this is the quickest way of missing the bus.
So if joy and happiness are byproducts, what exactly are they byproducts of? It was time to delve deeper into the qualities of mind and heart that we needed to cultivate to catch that bus. We have now covered the nature of true joy and the obstacles to joy, I said as we began our fourth day of dialogues. Now we are ready to move on to the positive qualities that allow us to experience more joy. We had discussed the topic of mental immunity in reducing fear and anger and other obstacles to joy, but the Dalai Lama had explained that mental immunity was also about filling our mind and heart with positive thoughts and feelings. As our dialogue progressed, we converged on 8 pillars of joy. 4 were qualities of the mind: perspective, humility, humor, and acceptance. 4 were qualities of the heart: forgiveness, gratitude, compassion, and generosity. On the first day, the Archbishop had touched the fingers of his right hand to his heart to emphasize its centrality. We would end up, ultimately, at compassion and generosity. And indeed, both men would insist that these 2 qualities were perhaps most pivotal to any lasting happiness. Yet we needed to begin with some fundamental qualities of the mind that would allow us to turn more easily and frequently to the compassionate and generous response to life. As the Dalai Lama had said at the start of our dialogues, we create most of our suffering, so we should be able to create more joy. The key, he had explained, was our perspective and the thoughts, feelings, and actions that come as a result. Scientific research consistently supported so much of the dialogue that was unfolding over the week. The factors that psychologist Sonia Libermirsky has found to have the greatest influence on our happiness supported a number of the 8 pillars. The first concerned our perspective toward life, or as Lubomirsky described, our ability to reframe our situation more positively. Our capacity to experience gratitude and our choice to be kind and generous were the others. A healthy perspective really is the foundation of joy and happiness, because the way we see the world is the way we experience the world. Changing the way we see the world in turn changes the way we feel and the way we act, which changes the world itself. Or as the Buddha says in the Dhammapada, with our mind we create our own world.
For every event in life, there are many different angles. When you look at the same event from a wider perspective, your sense of worry and anxiety reduces, and you have greater joy.
The Dalai Lama had discussed the importance of a wider perspective when he was telling us about how he was able to see the calamity of his losing his country as an opportunity. It was jaw-dropping to hear him reframe more positively the last half century of exile. He had been able to see not only what he had lost, but also what he had gained. Wider contact and new relationships, less formality and more freedom to discover the world and learn from others.
So, therefore, if you look from one angle, you feel, oh, how bad, how sad. But if you look from another angle at that same tragedy, that same event, you see that it gives me new opportunities.
Edith Eva Eger tells the story of visiting 2 soldiers on the same day at William Beaumont Army Medical Center at Fort Bliss. Both were paraplegics who had lost the use of their legs in combat. They had the same diagnosis and the same prognosis. The first veteran, Tom, was lying on his bed knotted into a fetal position, railing against life and decrying his fate. The second, Chuck, was out of bed in his wheelchair, explaining that he felt as if he had been given a second chance in life. As he was wheeled through the garden, he had realized that he was closer to the flowers and could look right into his children's eyes. Eger often quotes fellow Auschwitz survivor Viktor Frankl, who said that our perspective toward life is our final and ultimate freedom. She explains that our perspective literally has the power to keep us alive or to cause our death. One of her fellow inmates at Auschwitz was terribly ill and weak, and others in her bunk asked her how she was holding on to life. The prisoner said that she had heard that they were going to be liberated by Christmas. The woman lived against all odds, but she died on Christmas Day when they were not liberated. It's no wonder that during the week the Dalai Lama had called some thoughts and feelings toxic, even poisonous. Jinpa explained that while changing our emotions is quite hard, changing our perspective is actually relatively easy. It is a part of our mind over which we have influence. The way you see the world, the meaning you give to what you witness, changes the way you feel. It can be the first step of a spiritual and neural journey that results in more and more equanimity, and of our default state being increasingly more joyful. As psychologist and writer Daniel Goleman poetically put it on a pre-trip call. Perspective, Jinpa argued, is nothing less than the skull key that opens all of the locks that imprison our happiness. What is this perspective shift that has such power? What is the healthy perspective that the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop bring to life that allows them to greet life with so much joy in the face of so much sorrow? The Dalai Lama used the terms wider perspective and larger perspective. They involve stepping back within our own mind to look at the bigger picture and to move beyond our limited self-awareness and our limited self-interest. Every situation we confront in life comes from the convergence of many contributing factors. The Dalai Lama had explained, "We must look at any given situation or problem from the front and from the back, from the sides and from the top and the bottom, so from at least 6 different angles. This allows us to take a more complete and holistic view of reality, and if we do, our response will be more constructive. We suffer from a perspectival myopia. As a result, we are left nearsighted, unable to see our experience in a larger way. When we confront a challenge, we often react to the situation with fear and anger. The stress can make it hard for us to step back and see other perspectives and other solutions. This is natural, the Archbishop emphasized throughout the week, but if we try, we can become less fixated or attached, to use the Buddhist term, to one outcome and can use more skillful means to handle the situation. We see that in the most seemingly limiting circumstance, we have choice and freedom, even if that freedom is ultimately the attitude we will take. How can a trauma lead to growth and transformation? How can a negative event actually become positive? We were being invited to see the blessing in the curse, the joy in the sorrow. Jinpa offered a silver lining thought experiment to take us out of our limited perspective. Take something bad that happened in the past, and then consider all the good that came out of it. But is this simply being Pollyanna? Are we seeing the world less clearly when we view it through these rose-colored glasses? I do not think anyone would accuse the Dalai Lama or Archbishop Tutu of not seeing the struggles they have faced or the horrors of our world with keen and unflinching vision. What they are reminding us is that often what we think is reality is only part of the picture. We look at one of the calamities in our world, as the Archbishop suggested, and then we look again, and we see all those who are helping to heal, those who have been harmed. This is the ability to reframe life more positively, based on a broader, richer, more nuanced perspective. With a wider perspective, we can see our situation and all those involved in a larger context and from a more neutral position. By seeing the many conditions and circumstances that have led to this event, we can recognize that our limited perspective is not the truth. As the Dalai Lama said, we can even see our own role in any conflict or misunderstanding. By stepping back, we can also see the long view and have a clearer understanding of our actions and our problems in the larger frame of our life. This allows us to see that even though our situation may seem challenging now, from the vantage point of a month, or a year, or a decade, these challenges will seem much more manageable. When the Archbishop was awarded the Templeton Prize in London, I had the opportunity to meet the Astronomer Royal of the United Kingdom, Sir Martin Rees, who explained to me that our Earth will exist for an equivalent amount of time as it has taken us to go from one-celled organisms to human beings. In other words, we are only halfway through our evolution on this planet. Thinking of our world's problems in this long sweep of planetary history really is the long view. It puts our daily concerns into a much broader perspective. This wider perspective also leads us beyond our own self-regard. Self-centeredness is most of our default perspective. It comes, quite understandably, from the fact that we are at the center of our world. But as the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop demonstrate so powerfully, we also have the ability to take on the perspectives of others. I remembered the Archbishop wondering if the person who had cut him off in traffic might be rushing to the hospital because his wife was giving birth or because a loved one was dying.
I have sometimes said to people, when you are stuck in a traffic jam, you can deal with it in one of two ways. You can let the frustration really eat you up, or you can look around at the other drivers and see that one might have a wife who has pancreatic cancer. It doesn't matter if you don't know exactly what they might have, but you know they are all suffering with worries and fears because they are human. And you can lift them up and bless them. You can say, "Please, God, give each one of them what they need." The very fact of not thinking about your own frustration and pain does something. I don't know why, but it will make you feel much better. And I think it has therapeutic consequences for your own health, physical and spiritual. But what does frustration help? I mean, you feel it in the pit of your tummy, the anger. I mean, you just get more angry. And after a while, you're going to develop ulcers in the stomach from the fact that you got annoyed at sitting in a traffic jam.
Taking a God's eye perspective, as the Archbishop might say, allows us to transcend our limited identity and limited self-interest. One does not have to believe in God to experience this mind-altering shift in perspective. The famous overview effect is perhaps the most profound example. Many astronauts have reported that once they glimpsed Earth from space, a small blue ball floating in the vast expanse, lacking our human-made borders, they never looked at their personal or national interests in quite the same way again. They saw the oneness of terrestrial life and the preciousness of our planetary home. Fundamentally, the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop were trying to shift our perspective from focusing on I and me and mine to we and us and ours. Earlier in the week, the Dalai Lama had referenced a classic study that suggested the constant use of personal pronouns leads to a greater risk of heart attack. In a multi-center prospective study of coronary heart disease, health researcher Larry Sherwitz found that people who more frequently said I, me, or mine had a higher risk of having a heart attack and had a higher risk of their heart attack being fatal. Sherwitz found that this so-called self-involvement was a better predictor of death than smoking, high cholesterol levels, or high blood pressure. A more recent study conducted by researcher Johannes Zimmermann found that people who more often use first-person singular words, I and me, are more likely to be depressed than people who more often use first-person plural, we and us. This was interesting evidence that being too self-regarding really does make us unhappy. When we have a wider perspective, we are also less likely to spend our time lost in self-referential thoughts, ruminating. Jinpa offered another thought experiment designed to take us out of our self-absorption, one that the Archbishop described using when he was in the hospital, being treated for prostate cancer, and that the Dalai Lama used when he was doubled over in pain from a gallbladder infection. Think about where you are suffering in your life, and then think about all the other people who are going through a similar situation. This perhaps is quite literally the birth of compassion, which means suffering with. The incredible thing the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop pointed out was that this suffering with others reminds us that we are not alone and actually lessens our own pain. This recognition of our interdependence begins to soften our rigid sense of self, the boundaries that separate us from others. The Dalai Lama had said earlier in the week, "If, on the other hand, I relate to others from the perspective of myself as someone different, a Buddhist, a Tibetan, and so on, I will then create walls to keep me apart from others." We were back at the conversation that began the week, when we had just gotten off the airplane and were sitting in the lounge of the airport. The Dalai Lama had asked, "Where is Bishop Tutu's self? We can't find it." The Dalai Lama, in a traditional twist of Buddhist reasoning, said, "This is his body, but not himself. This is his mind, but not himself." Buddhists follow this line of inquiry to reduce our attachment to our identity, recognizing that the less attached we are, the less defensive and reactive we will be, and the more effective and skillful we can be. As the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop explained, the wider perspective leads to serenity and equanimity. It does not mean we don't have the strength to confront a problem, but we can confront it with creativity and compassion rather than rigidity and reactivity. When we take the perspective of others, we can empathize with them. One starts to see the interdependence that envelops us all, which reveals that how we treat others is ultimately how we treat ourselves. We also are able to recognize that we do not control all aspects of any situation. This leads to a greater sense of humility, humor, and acceptance. Pillar 2. Humility. I tried to look humble and modest.
I want to respond to your comment about being at the funeral.
The Dalai Lama was referring back to the Archbishop's story about preaching at Chris Hani's funeral.
You mentioned when you spoke at the funeral that you did not consider yourself as superior. You were just one of them. That's very, very important.